Boom, we're on. Today's guest, we've got London's Ray Bishop. How are
James,
you, brother?
Lovely to meet you at last.
Yeah, eventually, mate. Yeah, you've led a very interesting life, brother.
Yeah, somewhat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Your books, what we'll touch on, Outlaw. You've just gave me it, so I will get reading it, brother.
You like the pictures.
Yeah, probably, mate. I struggle to read, mate. But you've led a very interesting life from being one of Britain's most wanted men. You've nearly spent over 20 years in prison. Armed robberies, drugs, people trafficking. You've done it all. Drug addiction.
Yeah.
But the beauty of life, brother, you changed.
Most definitely. You know, I'm a great reformist. I think, now when my autobiography came out and I wrote it for Virgin, it was Noel Razor-Smith, very good friend of mine, fantastic author, as you know. He asked me to write it because he knew my story, he knew my tale. You know, I'd spent a lot of time with Razor when he was doing 25 years in the early 90s. I was locked up with him in Eyedown and our paths crossed again. He said, you've got to write your book. You've got a fascinating tale. It's almost unbelievable. So I wrote it. Razor took it. He'd give it to a publisher that he knew. The publishing company read it and said, this has to go to a major publisher. I was like, wow. You know, it's just my story. Mm-hmm. It went to Virgin, and Virgin said, we're going to release this, you know, and I was fucking blown away. The most wanted bit, bit sensationalised, that was Virgin to sell books. Obviously, I was for a period, you know, after I had escaped from prison, whatever else. But I don't know if I really like that so much because I'm a great reformist. It makes you sound a bit like Rail Moat or the Yorkshire fucking Ripper, which I ain't.
I get it. But so, like I say, those kind of stuff sells. And
it does.
At a point you were, so it is true.
Yeah.
You're good friends with Noel Razor-Smith. Great man.
Fantastic.
Another reformed character. He's doing amazing in life. Got a lot of love for Noel.
An
Terry Ellis as well, who's on the show.
Another
again.
Inspiration.
Billy Moore, who's became a good friend, who's
another
also been on.
Another
I love
friend
Billy.
Of mine.
He's became a very good friend, man, over the last year.
Billy's lived it. You know, I know Bill. Me and Bill go way back. Mm-hmm. You know, Bill comes from the same school as me. Yeah. You know, our paths have crossed on numerous occasions. You know, he's a fighting man, like I was myself. You know, he's a good man, Billy.
Love Billy.
As is Terry, as is
Oh,
Noel.
Yeah, them all. Billy, prayer before dawn, but shout out, because congratulations as well. His missus just had a son.
Yeah, fantastic,
Billy. Yeah, so,
and fantastic, Billy, for beating cancer. Cancer won't beat you, my old mate.
Yeah, nah, he's too strong. He's been through too much shit.
Yes,
and he's working on a second book, man. So,
again, mate, it's all fucking crazy characters we know, isn't it?
It's nuts, but...
I do know a few straight goers, you know?
So he says. So I always go back to the start with my guest, brother. Where you grew up and how it all began.
Well, I grew up in Woolwich, which is South East London. You know, normal working class family. Mother, Irish immigrant, you know, came here in the 60s. Dad wasn't around much. Dad was alcoholic. Dad was on the missing. Mother done the best she could. But, you know, it was tough times growing up. You know, I wasn't this tough kid, or I wasn't this man who I've been portrayed now. I mean, as a child, I was very frightened, very, very full of fear. Didn't feel like I had no place anywhere, didn't belong. And I guess I started to act as a young age to try to be accepted, if you know what I mean. And that meant, you know, I was pulled astray at a young age with the other kids on the estate. None of us had a lot. We didn't have a lot, no. And we all stuck together. And inevitably, at some point, we all ended up going down the wrong road, but for a multitude of reasons.
Yeah. So how was your upbringing from ages, from the teenage years? How was those years for you?
You know what? It was quite tough. You know, there wasn't a lot of love to go around, but it was because it was tough times, you know, tough times. You know, my mother done the best she could, as did my stepfather. I had siblings, you know, I was at the bottom of the pile, you know, older brother, older sisters. So, you know, it was a big family.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big family.
Bullied or anything?
Pardon?
Were you bullied or anything?
Well, at school I was. I used to have big ears. You know, I wasn't always as good looking as I am now. I'm quite intimidated because you've got a lovely mane of hair. But
thank you, brother. No.
But I used to have big ears. My ears used to stick out when I was a kid.
Did you get them pinned back?
I did. Yeah. And this is one of the defining moments in my childhood. I felt so inferior to other kids. I was so conscious of my ears. I actually took myself to the hospital, said to the doctors, I'm really sick of it and whatever. And they said, right, okay, we'll send you to get your ears pinned back. Now, when I had my ears pinned back, I got my ears pinned back in the Queen Elizabeth Military Hospital, which was, it was a military hospital. It's no longer a military hospital, in Woolwich. And it was at the time of the Falklands War. And I was on the same ward as Simon Weston, who I don't know if you know Simon Weston, he got blown up on the Bismarck or something in the Falklands, and he was all burnt, really badly burnt. I was on the same ward as him because it was a plastic surgery unit, and with the bandsman who had been blown up at Hyde Park as well. They were there, you know, and that's one thing I highlighted there in my book. I said, I never heard them moan once. You know, these were fellas, some of them had lost limbs. Simon Weston was so badly burned. All I remember is they used to put him in a cold bath in the morning and leave him there for hours because he was in so much pain. And God, the resilience of them men, incredible.
How old were you?
I was about 9 years old, I think, about nine. But what happened is there was a complication. When they done one of my ears, something went wrong. So I had to go on to this plastic surgery unit to have more constructive work done on one of my ears. And because they were all military doctors, they all had like military names. And I was in a plastic surgery burns unit, and the person who done my operation was called Major Burns. you couldn't write this stuff, could you?
So how was it then? So you were kind of bullied and you just kind of wanted it to stop. How was it then getting older? What age did you start kind of getting into crime?
Well, I was bullied as a kid. I was full of fear. I wasn't one of these tough kids. I don't want to sit here and I was one of these big, hard kids, and I was never a bully myself. Always hated bullies. But I started to get into crime and drugs probably when I was about 15, 16. And it was just silly little things like nicking car radios, shoplifting, all this sort of stuff. And it was the norm. It was what people did. But again, you know, I don't make excuses for the bad choices I made. But at the time, I didn't really know much different. You know, it was tough times, it was a tough council estate. There was not a lot to go around. None of us had a lot. It was Thatcher's Britain. And in a lot of senses, we were the fucking lost generation. You know, the Conservative Party at the time invested in our future by building this big prison called Belmarsh, where I live. You know, my Woolwich is here, Belmarsh is here. And as quick as it was going up, the police used to come on the estate and they used to tell us, you're all going to be in there soon. Mm-hmm. And that was the truth. And some of us ended up in there for things we hadn't even fucking done. Didn't make much difference to them.
Getting stitched up?
Oh, most definitely.
From what age?
First time I got stitched up for something I hadn't done. Now, I don't want to paint this thing that I was always squeaky clean. I wasn't. I was doing bits and bobs or whatever. First time, police burst through my house, 6 o'clock in the morning. I was in bed with my partner. I was about 17 years old because I was a young dad. I was a dad at 16. I was about 17 years old. They said, we've just seen you driving a nick car. You're under arrest. What are you fucking talking about? I'm in bed. No, we've just chased you. You've just come. And, you know, it's nothing to do with me. Nick me, charged me. Was I convicted? Of course I fucking was. Go to court. Guilty. You know?
What was your first sentence?
My first sentence was a young offenders institution. I think I went away for 7 months, I think.
How was that first time inside?
If I'm to be brutally honest, I was full of fear. I won't lie to you. You know, when I first walked through the doors of Feltham, you heard all these stories about whatever or some whatever. But I was quite fortunate because although I was full of fear, the minute I got on the wing, I knew lots of people. So, and it was always that way for me. You know, I'd end up going, and because I was from an estate with loads of people who were similar to me and whatever else, and if you didn't know someone, you knew their brother, their cousin, or whatever. So I knew people from day one.
Yeah. What age did you start boxing?
I was boxing as a kid. You know, I went to St. Peter's, which was...
Was that to stop the bullies?
You know, I just went into it because it was there, it was available. We used to have PE classes. The caretaker of the school, Mr. Gange, was fantastic. And we used to have all the boxing bags and all that in the gym, you know. If I had my way, I'd bring it back in schools, but that's another debate altogether.
Yeah.
And I started boxing there as a kid and didn't really have that many amateur fights, but I trained. I used to spar and train and train and train. And, Yeah, so I got into it quite young.
Yeah. What age did you start getting into the serious stuff?
Serious fighting or serious crime?
Serious crime.
Well, I suppose I started to get into serious crime in my early 20s. Yeah. Early 20s.
Robberies?
Robberies, yeah.
Banks, post offices?
Banks, post offices.
The mall?
Building societies, yeah. Bureau de changes.
What was it like doing your first job?
First job, I was the driver on one of my first jobs. And then after that, I was in, yeah.
Yeah. And that was you. Did you get a buzz for it?
Most definitely.
Do you?
I'd be lying if I said I didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was the starting point of getting a bit of money, getting a bit of power.
Yeah. Yeah. But then we had a spate of shootings in our area. The police started shooting robbers. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember. It was a period where they had a shoot to kill policy. They had a unit called PT-17.
Yeah, they've still got that, have they not?
Well, there was SO-19, which was like the flying squad, sort of whatever. I mean, I'm not a police expert, but I do know this squad was called PT-17. Mm-hmm. They were a fucking execution squad. And what they were doing was the armed robbery rate had gone up so high, they said, right, we're going to, whatever. I think it was Douglas Hurd was the Home Secretary at the time. He said, take a few out and that will get rid of... We were like the young cattle. Were we organised? Were we like the fucking Ocean's 11? No, we fucking weren't. We were just game kids doing crazy fucking things.
Kamikaze.
We could have a robbery one day for 200 quid and another day we'd have one for 10 grand. Mm-hmm. It was sometimes I've done two in a week. I robbed the same post office four times in 2 months before. You know, mm-hmm. I'm not proud of it, but that's the sort of robbers we were. But anyway, yeah, on our area, there was the generation just above me. Two of them got shot dead on a security van, and my other friend, as he turned to run away, they shot him in the back. So that tells you
they
were doing.
Yeah. Did that ever scare you to go?
Most definitely. And it brought the armed robbery rate down. Mm-hmm. And then what we'd done criminally, we were probably the original smash and grab gang.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if you remember the ram raids and mm-hmm. whatever else.
Killers.
Well, we sort of started that off, mm-hmm. like a little crew that I was with, and we'd done a few crazy things like that, a few good ones and a few funny ones.
Did you become more organised once you realised people were getting killed?
Definitely.
Yeah.
100%. Mm-hmm. And the sort of clientele that would pull you in. I mean, when you're into the robbery game and all that sort of stuff, there's a lot in the periphery. You know, you're talking about getaway cars and all sorts of bits and bobs and whatever, and some of the more major gangs at the time operating in our area, because we were good at nicking cars and things. These were skills we learned when we was young, nicking high performance vehicles or whatever. They'd say, right, can you nick a motor and leave it somewhere for us or whatever, and you go, yeah, no problem. They give you a little, and you don't know mm-hmm. whatever else happened, but you know mm-hmm. they want that car to do a bit of work and whatever. So there's a lot that goes on. So there was a lot more organisation.
Yeah. When did you get your first big sentence?
I got my first big sentence in about 1994. I think it was 94. I ended up getting 5 year, 9 month. I got a 3.5 year for a failed. It was going to be a robbery on a post office. We'd gone the day before and we had a thing where we used to foam the bell boxes. Back then they used to have these big, massive old bells, and they didn't used to be alarm, the actual post office. The alarm that you had on the outside was to what was called a trembler, which was on the safe, mm-hmm. and that was the only part of the building that was alarmed. So what we used to do the day before is go and fill it with expandable foam, so that if we went in to rob it and they set off the alarm, there'd be no ring mm-hmm. or whatever, and we got caught... I can talk about it. It was in Dartford. We got called. Two of my friends got arrested at the scene because we'd done it quickly in a vehicle, and I got arrested a mile and a half away in a phone box. Mm-hmm. No evidence whatsoever. You know, really and truthfully, I should have been on your way, but because of my affiliation to them and the police knowing I'm affiliated, I'm a mile and a half away. You're part of it. you're nicked.
Yeah, and you got a 5 for that?
I got 3.5 years for that. And what happened is my two pals got 2.5 years. One of them farted in the dock. I laughed, and the judge gave me an extra 12 months. I swear to God.
What?
I swear to fucking God, mm-hmm. I laughed at my mate, and they give me an extra fucking 12 months for laughing. Like, I was laughing at him.
Mm-hmm. Did you think he was laughing at the sentence?
He thought I was laughing at the severity of it all, sort of thing. And then I got, on top of that, I got another 2.5 years for, it was a high value burglary. I had over £500,000 out of a big main post office in Bromley. Not in money, I had it in items and whatever else. Back then you used to be able to get the phone stamps, electricity stamps and whatever. We used to take the fucking lot because you could sell them.
Yeah.
You know, I at times I had books of electric said, no one on my fucking estate paid an electric bill. So in some senses, yeah. It was like that sort of side of it was quite fucking fulfilling. You should do a bit of a Robin Hood,
yeah,
you know?
Robin Hood.
You could pay your phone bill, your electric bill, fucking everything.
Heating everything on. That's how you must have known. And just been done if everybody's fucking lights were on.
Well, the way
that
come on top is the way it come on top for us all. And we had, there was an observation put on our little crew at the time was because we had to get the books to put the stamps in to sell them because you couldn't sell them in sheets. You had to put them in the books and you'd sell the books sort of thing. And some fucking idiot walked into a post office and asked for like 500 books or something. Someone associated to us. So they, obviously they thought this is a bit suspicious. Mm-hmm. They've tipped the other mob off and the next thing you know is all our doors have gone.
Yeah. Did you have a tight crew?
Very much so.
Yeah. Did every one of you do big sentences?
Yeah. And some of them are dead. You know,
on a job?
Well, not on a job. I'm not going to say names or anything. A couple have died, drug overdoses. Mm-hmm. Another friend of mine got murdered. Another one took his own life. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of us. Like, I mean, it might be 20 of us or whatever, because we all interacted from different estates or whatever else. So I don't want to... And I laugh about whether I'm not laughing at the victims in it and whatever else. What I'm laughing at is the fucking craziness.
Yeah. Or thinking it was normal at one point.
And thinking it was normal, you know. My story's my story. Love me or hate me, it is what it is. But
exactly, man. Listen,
I'm totally the opposite now. Do you know what I mean?
Listen, we've all got a story, and the thing is, crime sells. But we'll touch on all the change and the things that you're doing now. But sometimes, mate, if you don't laugh, you'll cry.
I mean, it never ended up pretty. I mean, you know, I've got pals now that are doing 25 wrecks, 30 wrecks, 20 years. And a lot of my friends end up with big, big lumps of bird. The generation under us, I mean, you only got to look under us. We looked up to the ones above us, and the ones below us looked up to us. And look at their story.
Yeah.
You know, you've got from my area, like the Lee Murrays and... He, a formidable fella, you know, lovely lad. I've known since he was this high, hard as fucking nails, game as fuck, fucking UFC fighter and everything. And, you know, he ends up getting 25 years and it's fucking tragic.
Mm-hmm.
Tragic.
Yeah, that's the majority of people come on the podcast say they're a product of the environment as well.
Very much so.
And you tend to say there is a kind of link between abuse or bullying.
Oh, well, let me tell you something about bullying. The biggest bullies in my area when I was a kid was the fucking old Bill, was the police, you know. I don't hate the police now. I respect them. We need them. I don't have any dealings with them because I live a law-abiding life.
Mm-hmm.
But as a kid, they were fucking bastards. We had, we used to have anyone who's my age, I'm nearly 50 now, we had the SPG, which was the Special Patrol Group. They were like a tactical support unit. They used to come onto the estates in our area, vans full of them, like a van with 10, 12 coppers in them. Oh, and they used to give you an ID in or they'd drag you. I mean, my own experience, they nearly killed me one night. They arrested me one night at a petrol station. I done fuck all wrong. They dragged me out of a car, snatched a petrol pump out of my hand, and they put their foot on my back all the way back to the police station. I couldn't breathe. I was passing out in the back of the van. It was funny to them. You know?
So that's where the hate and rage can come towards authorities, eh? Police, screws.
Fucking scared of them when I was a kid. Like, we all were. We were scared of them because they wouldn't just... It wasn't, you know, they could arrest you and charge you and do... Who are you going to fucking complain to?
Mm-hmm.
The police? You know, this is in the days when I was criminally active when I was young. This is in the days before taped interviews and cameras and all that sort of stuff. Everything was done... I used to write it down.
Piece of paper.
Yeah, and we had this saying, anyone from my year will tell you, verbal, what they would do is fucking write things, you know. And the older criminals in our area used to say, if you ever get to never sign a statement, but they'd sign it for you. But they say, if you ever do, put MUD, and it means made under duress. Like, I don't know if we thought we was these international fucking terrorists or something. But many a time when I was arrested when I was young, I said, I didn't fucking say that. I didn't say that.
Yeah.
I didn't say that. Like, I admitted to doing this and doing that, and I said this, and I never fucking said that. You know, they had
crooked as
pre-prepared statement. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
When you get out of jail after your first sentence, after your, was it four, five, three and a half? What was your life like then? Did you go straight back into crime?
Do you know what? I went into the smuggling world then, but I tried to go straight. I did. I'd be lying if I said I didn't, because I don't think, you know, criminality and crime and all that stuff. You see people and you say, oh, he's a criminal, whatever, and you can write them off, whatever. I don't believe anyone's fucking truly criminal. I believe if someone's earning 10 grand a week doing crime, you'd think, fucking hell, this man. But what if you could say to them, I'll tell you, I'll give you 10 grand a week to do something legal. I'm sure they'd pick the legal option. Mm-hmm. Do you see what I'm saying? I did try. But the trouble is, once you're labelled, once you're in that mix, it's against you. You know, society doesn't forgive. It's based on fucking retribution. We all like to say people get out of prison, give them a second chance and whatever else. Go to prison and get out and see how many chances you get.
So you started going down the smuggling route?
I did, yeah, from people I'd met in jail. I've always been very good with people. Mm-hmm. And the one thing I'm not is fucking dumb. I'm not stupid. And I'm as staunch as they come, I'll me mouth shut, I don't blag and all that sort of stuff. And
what were you smuggling gear, Charlie?
At the time, cannabis.
Hash?
Yeah, this was in the 90s. We were smuggling cannabis. Yeah.
From abroad?
Yeah, plenty Spain. Of it and all. Yeah, they were bringing it up from Spain. Mm-hmm. It was coming down from Holland as well, into France. It was coming back via day trippers and whatever else. My job, I used to go out. There was a situation where we'd have the Dutch would bring it down into France, and one of us would go to meet the Dutch, take it from the Dutch and give it to the day tripper, because you never wanted the two to meet.
Mm-hmm.
Never wanted the two to meet. The Dutch, in my experience, don't trust them. They're iffy fuckers. MI5 and all them people and all these security services and all that, that is where they operate. That's where all their snitches are out there. But anyway, cut a long story short. So he would never meet the day tripper. And this was at the time when a lot of the European football matches were on and whatever else. And it was a smuggler's fucking paradise. The people I work with had the best routes. What customs officer wants... There's 10 coaches of English fans coming through at the port. What customs officer wants to get a load of pissed up English fans off on the dock and start searching them? It's get them fuckers through.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd have a day, well, the people I work for would have a day, people coming over either as day trippers or coming over as football fans. I would have met the Dutch a few days before. I'd be plotted in an hotel. I'll meet them at the match, give them the bags that go on the coach. You just sling them on. If it come on top on the coach, worst thing that's going to happen.
How many kilo?
30 at time, 40 at time, 50 at time. When we done the runs on the ribs, because we done that as well, a couple, actually across the channel on ribs, it was bigger quantities.
Ever get caught?
I never know, but someone who I work with did through stupidity.
Yeah, someone in Glasgow used to do the hash runs, man, but they used to do it. They used to take the school kids over to Spain.
I know people who, it's despicable.
It's
like the money involved.
They used to take the school kids, man, and you're talking hundreds of kilos.
I know people have done it on old people.
Yeah, somebody wrote that. It was in someone's book in Glasgow, man. I was like, fucking
I'm not making it right.
Yeah, I know, but
you know, but
the lengths you go to make a crust, and the people who you use is next level shit, isn't it?
I mean, the crew I worked with at the time, I mean, I'm not giving it, I'm the big fucking mighty organiser. I wasn't. I was a pivotal player and played the role, but I was only a soldier. I wasn't the Mr. Biggs, the big brains.
Yeah.
You know, the people I worked for were very successful. Mm-hmm. They knew what the fuck they were doing.
Yeah. Did you get caught for that?
No. I eventually got caught and got 10 years for people smuggling, people into Britain.
What kind of people? Like refugees?
Well, this is in the days. I mean, this was 99, 2000. I think I got nicked in 2000, my memory serves me well. This is before the days of the open borders and whatever. Then the Russians wanted to preempt it. You know, Russia had broken up into all the little states, hadn't it? Georgia, what was it? You had Georgia, the... Kosovo, all these places, mm-hmm. Serbia and all these, there'd been wars out there and everything. They wanted to preempt it. It was people knew that eventually they'd be allowed in anyway, but at the time they wasn't. So the people I worked with, the gangs that they were working with out there, you know, they were highly organised firms, you know, all throughout the continent, and we ended up involved with them and bringing people into the UK. Mm-hmm.
So you went from bank robbery, smuggling drugs to smuggling people, and you got a 10 for that?
It's fucking crazy, isn't it?
Yeah. So what was your 10 like? Where did you go? Prison?
At first, I didn't like it, because between me and you, I'm actually the first person in this country to be banned from holding a British passport. No, the second. The first one before me was a fella called Perry Waker. He was a Dutchman, and what happened is he had 52 people in a lorry and they all died, didn't they? I don't know if you remember. And he got banned from holding a British, holding a passport. And I got banned as well for holding a passport, because this was when people smuggling first started. You know, I didn't really want to get involved in this people smuggling. I wasn't a willing participant. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of reasons why I'd done what I'd done. And I was duped into doing it. And I only ever done it the once. And I got caught when I fucking done it. But like I say, I was actually arrested in France. I didn't commit an offence in Great Britain. I should have been tried, arrested in France. But because it was this new big thing, this people smuggling, and Britain had realised what a security threat it was to the country, they sent a team of customs over to Coquel in France.
They extradited you?
What they'd done is they duped me and said, we need to take you to hospital to make sure you're fit to be questioned. And they drove me over into the English control zone.
And charged you?
They said, you're now under arrest. Drove me back.
Did they have a warrant for that?
Nope. It was totally illegal. Every move they fucking done was illegal. Technically, I was kidnapped by British Customs and brought back to the UK, because of the people smuggling at the time was such a big thing, and they didn't want it to be...
a new trend.
Exactly. So they wanted to give deterrent sentences or whatever else. But what happened to me is when I got... And this is how... But this goes on to how I became Britain's Most Wanted Man. When I was arrested, you know, it was... The people I'd worked for, you know, I was fucking pissed. I'd been stitched up, basically set up, because this wasn't a firm I usually work with. I'd been put into them, cut a long story short. And I thought, fuck this, I need to go and sort this out. So they took me to Folkestone Court a week later. I was remanded into custody, obviously. I was in Canterbury Prison, and I was taken to Folkestone Magistrates Court. Now, Folkestone Magistrates Court was a high security court, believe it or not, because of the... If you get nicked for smuggling, and some of these cases, people get nicked at the ports, Dover, Folkestone, whatever, some of them are nicked with big fuck-off parcels, and some of them are like major, whatever, so it's a high security court. I thought, how the fuck am I going to get out of here? So I worked out a plan. I thought, the only way I'm going to get out is I need to make some sort of weapon that's intimidating enough. And at the time, I thought... Right, I'll get a pen. So I got a big pen, a paper clip, and I filled it up with blackcurrant jam. And I took the prison officer hostage in the courtroom and said, if I don't open the doors, I'm going to inject him. So they opened all the doors. So at the time, they opened the doors and let me go. When I eventually got arrested 3 months later, I was done for 23 false imprisonments, including the fucking judge.
Mm-hmm. Fuck's sake.
Madness.
What sentence did you get? The 10?
I got another 3 year consecutive.
So you get
for
a 13?
That. Yeah, another 3 years on top for that. Mm-hmm.
Where did you go to when you were on the run?
Do you know what? I'd like to say, yeah, I went to Spain and I had a big pot of money and all that. I didn't. I ended up going back to my area, what I knew, where I knew best. You know, sometimes you're better off hiding under their nose and you go back to where you know best. And I wasn't in the best place mentally at the time. That's it. I got into that, you know. I was using drugs at the time. I was using cocaine and whatever else. I think I'd reached a crossroads. I'd had enough of the crime and everything. And I think that was the first sort of struggle with me where I was struggling mentally. And I didn't understand depression and things like that at the time. But I was struggling mentally because the act of escaping, even after I'd done it, you know, after I'd escaped and I broke out of the court, you know, there was no one waiting for me outside on a motorbike to whiz me away or anything like that. You know, I went down the beach, Folkestone Beach, and I see the police helicopter flying about looking for me or whatever else. So, and I saw a woman with a baby and I thought, oh, stop. And I lied down and talked to her, whatever. So they've obviously just, you know, and then 3 hours later, I bunked a train back to fucking Woolwich. and ended up in a fucking drug dealer's house saying, fucking, I've just escaped. And he's going, yeah, shut up, you fucking idiot. And then the 6 o'clock news comes on, police are looking for this man, do not approach, all this bollocks. And that weren't nice, you know, to see that. I think that was that. And then obviously I armed police at my mum's looking for me, going around my ex-partner's house looking for me, fucking everyone looking for me. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't nice.
That's the hard thing when the coppers terrorise the family.
Oh, there's nothing nice about being on the run. I was on the run for like about 4.5 months before they eventually called me.
Where did they catch you?
In my home area.
Did you never think about...
But right,
did you never think about doing another ton and getting to fuck?
Listen, at the time, I knew I was fucked. Mm-hmm. I knew the minute I was nicked, I was in a lot of trouble. I knew, you know, I'm not a stupid man.
Potentially a lifer?
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah. With my record as well. At the time, I'd already had a conviction for firearms, mm-hmm. Section 18 and whatever else. When I got caught, it was almost a relief. But when I was on the run, the fear, you know, I they're going to shoot me. They're going to shoot me. That's what I was thinking, because I'd had a conviction for firearms. Anyone who's been arrested for firearms will tell you that when you're arrested for firearms, you have this marker against you. It's like, even to this day, if a police car comes up behind my vehicle and my name comes up,
flag up,
they won't stop me. Not one car. Before they pull me over, there'll be 3 or 4
armed bonds.
Yeah, because of
the danger.
The danger.
What was your 13 like? What jail did you go to?
Well, most of it high security. And I'm not saying that, but ego effect. But obviously, because of the escape and whatever else, most of it was in high security. I was up in the dispersal system, Long Larton, and that was a.
You're in Belmarsh?
I was in Belmarsh, yeah.
You're in Bronson?
I've been in with Bronson twice.
How about Charlie?
Do you know what?
I've actually seen he's getting out next year.
I was in the block with him. I was in the seg with him because I used to be a little fucker in jail. Mm-hmm. You know, I used to think it was a laugh and plan. However, in 1995, I was in the seg with him in Highdown. And I got to know him then. I used to speak to him through the wall. He used to have his exercise yarn. He'd go out and just train like a lion. Do you know what? What I say about Charlie is fucking release him.
He got his appeal today.
Who would you rather have living next door to you? Charlie Bronson or a fucking or a child killer? And the reality of it is, there's child killers that have served fucking a quarter of what he's done. Yeah. He's no danger to anyone. He'll go on to be a celebrity or whatever else. Mm-hmm. He's a danger to them. Charlie doesn't assault prisoners or anything. He's actually a really nice guy.
Is he reformed now?
Pardon?
Is he reformed then?
It's not for me to say.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to wind him up.
Is he a big boy? Is he strong?
He's a very strong man. He's a circus strong man, isn't he, Charlie? Yeah. He's a circus strong man. I wrote to him when my book came out. You know, I wrote to him and said to him, and he was kind enough in my book. He done me a drawing and he said, "Box smart, Ray. You done good," and that meant a lot because. Mm-hmm. You know, be patronising to say I know he feels. You know, I've done a lot of seg myself. I've done some high security jails and very high security conditions. But you can't even comprehend what it must be like to be in the seg as long as he's been in there. You know, you can't even comprehend it. He's not the only one.
Yeah.
There's a lot of others in there that you don't hear about because they're not got the celebrity status. You know, like Tony Steele and Bob Maudsley and people like that. They've been in the seg 30-odd years.
Who are they?
Well, Bob Maudsley, I was in the Long Larton seg with him. He killed 3 people in jail, Bob Maudsley. He killed 3 sex offenders up in Wakefield jail, and he came out on the wing one day. We killed one in Broadmoor, and then he was in Wakefield, and he came out one morning and said to the prison officers, "There'll be 2 off this morning," and they just looked at him and thought, "What are you doing? What do you mean?" He'd killed them both and put them under their beds. But he's been in segregation now for 35 years, you know. You don't hear about these cases.
Who's the other man you mentioned there?
Tony Steele. Tony Steele's from my area, from Woolwich. I remember Tony as a kid. And Tony Tony got nicked for... I think he went away for nicking a milk float or something crazy like that. And that was about 25 years ago. He's been in prison ever since, all for crimes committed in prison. Assaults on prison officers and whatever else, and he'd get 10 year and I think he got life for assaulting prison officers or whatever, and they threw him off the roof in Whitemore. Prison officers threw him off the roof. He managed to get up on the roof, and the prison officers grabbed him. Whatever. I can't say they threw him off, but people I spoke to said they fucking threw him off. They said he jumped, but he survived it. But yeah, he's been in the sex for years.
So how was that sentence? When did you decide to go to Grendon?
Well, what happened, you know, I'm coming across like a bit of a nutter here, but...
You are a fucking nutter, mate. Enjoy it.
What happened? In 2002, I was in Long Line. You know, I did that wall, you know, where they say...
Just sick of that life.
Conscience becomes a fierce pursuer. And the life I'd lived, you know, I'd lived that fucking life, you know. I don't talk bollocks, you know. I'd lived it, seen it, done it. There's things I would never talk about, but I'd lived it, seen it, done it in more ways than one. And I'd reached that road, and I went to therapy in Dovegate. You know, they took me off the playlist, and I went up to Dovegate. I thought, right, I'm going to give it a go, because they'd half sold it to me. And that was all the way up in New Toxic. But the thing was, it's too far away, and I'm a Londoner through and through, and they've stuck me in this jail right up north. There was two fellas on the wing who, in my eyes at the time, were fucking no good. One of them was, half a wrong'un, like one of the other lot. He come out, we was doing this group thing, and he said he'd been flashing the school kids or something. And then I had a little scam up there of another fella. We were getting bits sent in the post, and nick a few quid like you do when you're in jail, trying to make it a bit better for yourself. And this other one grassed us up. So one day I thought, right, that's it, they got to go. And at lunchtime, I'd done the pair of them with a honey jar. So I got nicked for two bad Section 18s when I was in... the police are not all bad. Because what happened, I got nicked with these two Section 18s, and Derbyshire police come to arrest me, obviously. You know, and I'm already doing 13 year, two Section 18s, my record, get lifed off or get another big lump of bird. The cop has come into the seg to interview me, and he's looked out the door like that, and he's gone, we know they were wrong'uns. He went, just say he went to it, yeah, and you stuck your arm up in the honey jar with him. He said, I'm happy with that. I went, yeah, that's what happened. He went, sweet, you won't hear from us again. And I never fucking did.
So you could have got a life off of that?
I got a life, and they knew one of them was in a fucking flashing or something else. Mm-hmm. And the other one was fucking no good. I never know what he was in for. But the old Bill knew they were no good. They knew it's a prison assault. They don't give a shit. You know, when you're in prison, you can kill each other. As long as you don't kill us. That's their philosophy, and I'll go into that with the prisons, especially the high security prisons. But yeah, they sort of went... But then the downside of that was obviously I was made high security again, back to Long Line. Now, when I was in Long Line, they put me straight back into segregation because of my assaults on and whatever else. I think you're a danger to other people. And they was worried about my mental health at the time as well because of the outburst and whatever. And because of my escape. When you escape and use them extreme methods, not that they consider you dangerous, they think you're fucking off your head. And in some senses they were, but off their head people can be quite dangerous. But cut a long story short, when I was in the segregation, when you're in the segs in high security jails, they're called, you know, most jails are called segregation. When you're in the high security jails, they're called special care and control units. They changed the name to make it sound a bit more PC. But what that means is you have to be assessed by psychologists and psychiatrists. Every dispersal prisoner does. There's only six maximum security prisons in the country. And when you're in them, you get assessed by psychiatrists and psychologists. You go one route. You either progress through the system, or if they think you're too dangerous, you ain't going nowhere. The options for me were the severe and dangerous personality unit at Whitemore, because they thought I was dangerous. Or go back into therapy and give it another go. The psychiatrist tapped the pen on the tabletop. He said, one signature and I can send you to Broadmoor. And you know what? That fucking scared me, because I knew he weren't joking, because I'd seen it happen. I'd seen people go, you know. Two psychiatrists go, yeah, we think he needs, he's criminally, whatever he needs. He's a dangerous society. Where you're off to Broadmoor. And if you go to somewhere like that, you ain't coming out till you're old. You know, it's not like you go there and have 6 months or whatever. You go there, you're fucking lost. Or they will chemically lobotomy you. They'll, like the one flew over the cuckoo's nest. They'll just keep filling you up with psychotropic meds till you're off your fucking head. You'll want to stay there. You won't want to go
just
anywhere.
Just dumb you down.
If you was to go there and walk around the case, these people have been there 35, 40 years. Mm-hmm. there's a fella in there, I read about it a few years ago, he burnt a haystack as a kid. He's been in there 45 fucking years. That's what you're up against. Yeah. That's their control measure.
You're going in there sane and coming out insane.
Or dead.
Yeah.
Or dead.
Did that scare you then?
Most definitely. Because I was sane, but at the same time there was something wrong with me. I didn't know what it was, but I believe what's always been wrong with me is like addiction and that stuff. But also, I'll go into it later because I'm quite open about mental health. I was diagnosed as being bipolar further down the line. But yeah, that was my options. And then I thought, you know what? All I knew about Grendon, it's like Terry Ellis says so beautifully, you know, Terry's book's fantastic. And when he says about it's full of wrong ones and full of beasts. Well, at the time, I was quite fortunate. Because the new one had opened in Dovegate, the numbers had gone right down in Grendon. So what they were trying to do was empty the dispersals out of prisoners. They go, right, well, you want to go down? So they started taking armed robbers and normal career criminals and whatever else. So when I went there, you know, I was very fortunate that there was people I already knew from the system. Other people had gone from the dispersal system. Two other fellas came from Long Lighting with me who were both normal stand-up. Since both lifers, both in for murder, but what I would call my own, like decent criminals. All right, they've been nicked for murder. That's their story. But yeah.
How was it then going there?
At first,
was that a tough decision for you?
Oh, most definitely, most definitely. Breaking down the ethos and the barriers and all that stuff. But I was very fortunate, you know, because people know me and know what I'm about. People, you know, I'm not claiming to be big gangs and a Britain's like London's biggest feared fucking gang. Who fucking wants to be?
Yeah.
But what I am is quite well known in the system. Well, I was back then, and I was well known for probably all the wrong reasons, but amongst my own for the right reasons, for being staunch, for standing up with people, for standing firm with people, for standing tall, and standing up to authority, which I've done on numerous occasions. You know, I earned my stripes more than once. You know what I mean? And so I was known for being staunch. So I had a... You know, water finds its own level, like attracts like. So whenever I've been in prison, especially high security estates, I've attracted the best of the best. And I'm friendly with some of the, what you would call the elite of the Britain's criminal underworld or whatever, people that you read about, whatever. I'm very friendly with a lot of them people. And certain people I love and respect dearly, like Kevin Lane and people like that in Long Light. And I went and said to them, look, I'm thinking about going to this therapy and all that. And do you know what? In prison, you make friendships, you forge friendships, you know. If you're a fraud and all that, you get found out. And people like that are so staunch that they said to me, you know what, Ray, it's got to be better than here. It's the best movie. And when you hear it from people like that, like proper staunch people, you sort of go, I'll give it a go.
Yeah.
You go to fucking wankers, they'll go, oh, it's all full of fucking wrong, it's full of nonsense, full of this, full of that. Half of them are absolute cunts themselves, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
A sensible person, a true friend will tell you the truth and say, do what's best for you.
Because Grendon's known as one of the most evilest prisons for the prisoners with child killers, child rapists, bad people.
There.
But from Noel Razor-Smith, who's been on it, changed his life, Terry Ellis, been there, changed his life. It takes courage and respect for anybody to admit they've got a problem and potentially this is our last chance to make changes.
Part of the reason why I love Razor-Smith so much is I attribute Razor-Smith to half saving my life. And another person I'd like to mention just briefly, Louis Birch, God bless his soul.
Who's he?
Louis was prolific armed robber, prolific security van robber and all that in the 80s and 90s. He died recently. But when I first went to Grendon, Louis Birch was there. Louis was on, and I knew Louis from Woolwich. You know, Louis was old school, as hardcore as they come. And Razor turned up from Whitemore the same fucking day I turned up from Long Lighting. And I knew Razor because I'd been with Razor in Idan in the 90s. You know, I knew he was starting his writing and whatever else. But Razor's as staunch as they come, you know, proper. You know, I've been in Belmarsh with Razor. He's a staunch fucking prisoner.
Yeah, he's a fucking
and the minute I see him there, and another fella, Freddie Lunn, and the two fellas that I come with from Long Lighting, who I was already quite pally with, a decent fella, we had our own little crew. And our take on it was, fuck them, we're here for us. Mm-hmm. And we all carried each other through it. And I was there for 3 years. You know, it was a fucking tough.
How was it
years.
Working on yourself, getting therapy, psychology?
I would say, for me, best thing I ever done. best thing I ever done. Not easy. It's an ongoing process. I didn't come out of there a closed book, but I started to break down the barriers. There was, you know, when I went there, it was us and them. I hated Screws, hated authority. Lot of experience of prison brutality and all that stuff. I'd been on the receiving end of it. I'd witnessed it, the injustice of it or whatever. But the officers there were different, you know. Joe Chapman, Paul Johnson, you know, these people, they're dedicated, dedicated to helping us change our life for us and to fucking stop creating victims. And they made us see it, challenged us, told, asked us questions and told us things that we'd never encountered before. My way of dealing with everything was attack. Here's a classic example. I'd been there 3 months. Someone sent me in a CD, and I really wanted this CD, like a kid. I really wanted this CD. So I've gone up reception to get this CD, and the prison officer behind the counter said, you can't have it. You're not allowed to miss a prohibited item or whatever. I thought, you cunt. First thing I've done, I've jumped the counter to attack him, you know. And he, Paul Johnson's grabbed me, pulled me back, pinned me up against the wall. Rather than trying to hit me or bundle me or bend me up, take me to the block, he's gone, where are you now? Where are you? And I was like, what do you mean? Where fucking are you now? Meaning, where are you mentally? Mm-hmm. And it brought me back to childhood. When I was a kid and, you know, when I and loss and yeah. not having things as a kid and all this stuff. It's mad how it fucking works.
Getting neglected, feel a wee bit of abandonment issues.
All that.
And that was your defence mechanism, getting angry.
Attack.
Yeah.
Attack.
And you identified all that while in there. Yeah. What was it like, your first therapy session being open? Did you talk about your bullying and stuff? Was that the first?
Not really.
You'd ever spoke about
it? It's a process. It takes time. Yeah. It takes time. I was more like, listen, bit cautious. We'd have our own little therapy sessions. Me, Razor, and Freddie and that. We'd go and we'd have our own little talks in the cell. Most of the time, it'd be that fucking nonce, that cunt, this, that, whatever. The usual prison stuff. But that becomes tiring. It's like when you're in prison, everyone wants to talk about fucking crime. Crime's fucking boring. Let's talk about something else. Everyone wants to talk about football. Fuck football. They're faggots. Yeah. You know, I want to... You know what I mean? It's... Yeah, so we used to do our own little therapy sessions. It might sound mad, but we were encouraged to do that. Mm-hmm. You're starting to open up in a way you never did before.
Yeah. How did you handle being around all the serial fucking evilness of some of those prisoners?
The beauty of it, and I'm not just saying this, there wasn't that many on our wing. Mm-hmm. And the reason there wasn't that many on our wing is because there were so many hardcore people like myself and Razor and Freddie and whatever. Yeah, they was trying to, let's see if this works for this mob now, rather than just the beast.
Yeah, that's still bad, but I'm talking about the child killers, the fucking evil, evil people. So they were kind of kept away from
you. They kept them away from us because they knew...
Shit could kick off.
Well, they would feel too intimidated to do their work. You know, the one thing I will say about them people is this. If they're there for the right reason... and they do the work on themselves, that they don't go out and create another victim, full respect to them. Full respect to them. And I'm sure there's been many success cases. If they're there working their ticket, they got found out. Because you can't kid a kid out. And the thing about people like myself, people who have grown up in prisons and done so much bird, is we can see straight through the bullshit and cut straight through the bullshit. So we give a lot of them an hard time. But in doing that, I think we fucking... played our own little bit in helping either rehabilitate them or we didn't, but you get an understanding. And the thing is, especially with them, what I will say about a lot of these people, not saying about rapists, murderers, whatever, the amount of them, when you actually hear their stories and why they're the way they are, it's fucking horrific. What some of these people have been through themselves, you know, they were put into care homes as kids, put into care homes by the state to be looked after and protected and whatever else, and they were fucking nonce themselves and abused and passed from care home to care home to care home, abused, 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 abused. That was all they fucking knew. Mm-hmm. So when some of them, believe you me, I'm not making excuses for them, but when some of them went on to be like that themselves, you sort of go, well, did we fail them as a society?
Yeah,
in some cases, yes.
Scary to fucking think, man.
No one's born like that, are they? That's what I'm trying to say. It's like, I can't say, oh, I went out committing robberies and putting guns in people's face and all that. That makes me in some way better. I would never harm a woman or a child intentionally. And you know, that stuff sickens me and disgusts me. Mm. But I was so at a place in myself where I wanted to fucking change and have some sort of quality of life myself and have a decent life beyond jail that I was willing to tolerate them to a degree. Not get pally with them or anything like that, but not attack them.
Whereas in the past... You try to be more understanding everybody's stories and understanding the backgrounds.
I would attack them like that in the past.
Yeah.
It's your duty in jail.
Is that the work ingrained and it changes your mindset to... look at things differently?
Well, it changes your mindset and everything's a deflection. The greatest, you know, if you're fucking a bad person yourself, you'll pick out the badness in others. If you're a good person, you'll find the good in others. So eventually what Grendon done for me is after a few months of being there, once we'd exhausted all that, he's a wrong and he's a cunt, he's a this, bollocks, you start to look at yourself. And that's when it became real. And that's when some people either stick it out or some people go, and there's many times I wanted to flee, many times I wanted to run, but I'd have like Big Brother Razor or someone say, stick it out, come on, stick it out, we're all in this, come on, stick it. And we pulled each other through, you know.
The 3 years that you were there, when you were going through all your therapy sessions, did you grow a conscience and think about all the victims, like the robberies and stuff 100%. Like that? Does that 100%. Become sad? Was there a lot of tears?
I'd be lying if I said I'm a weeper. And you know why? Because I'm a thinker. You know, my pain has always been...
overthinking.
I overthink stuff and whatever else. Did I get in touch with difficult emotions? Yes. Do I feel sorrow, pity, sadness for the victims I've created? Most definitely. But it doesn't come out with tears for me. The way it came out with me is in self-destruction. Drug abuse. Beating myself up. Putting myself in that way of life in the fucking first place. Crime, criminality, especially violent crime, is a form of self-harm. You might think you're harming someone else, but hurt people hurt people. And that's my experience. And it took therapy for me to actually understand and realise that. You know, and since I've made a change, I don't hurt people today. Do you know what I mean? It's because I understand if I'm feeling that way, it's because I'm fucking hurting. You know, for whatever else, for any unresolved guilt,
whatever. Yeah, I think harming others is self-harm. And I also think taking drugs is self-harming.
100%.
It's kind of, I had someone on my show and he says, like, they didn't want to live, but they didn't want to die. They just didn't know where they were. So the drugs was just pure escape, the Charlie, the everything. Were you taking drugs in the jail before Grendon? Were you on the gear?
I had a period, but then I had a period in Long Larton where in Long Larton it really frowned upon when you're around on a wing with like proper sensible fellas. They're not really into the drugs, it's more the booze. And what they do in
Hooch,
in the dispersal system, what the screws do, it's a control measure. Listen, there's bods in there, got fuck all to lose. They're doing life sentences, 30 wrecks, all sorts. You know, they want to have a booze, the screws will let them. As long as you don't beat us up, and you can have it. But once people start playing up, what they do is they turn it into a desert. They come in, they spend the center search squads in, nick everyone's booze. That pisses off the faces and the daddies and the wing and whatever. You fucking idiots playing up and all that. They've come and fucking nicked all our booze. So it's a bit of we'll give
come and go
and take. You know what I mean? It's a bit of a control measure. So in the dispersals, people mainly drink. And I did drink, but drink turns me into a nasty fucker. You know, I get involved in all sorts of... I ain't drunk for years, but... I'll get rowdy.
Push you over the edge.
Oh, yeah. Well, it did then because I was emotionally very damaged, very scarred. I hadn't done any therapeutic work on myself, so I'd have a booze and it'd be, let's have a row. And I'd want to start attacking staff or something stupid.
What jail were you... prison riot?
I've never been fortunate enough to be in a riot. But if I could have caused one, I probably would have done. No, I've never been involved in any riots or protests with anyone else because I don't want to drag anyone into my box. Yeah. Let me tell you something about prison riots. Prison riots go like this. Mr. fucking whatever has got the fucking he gets his fucking boys and then he sits back, you know, I'm not the one going to take the flak. You poor fuckers are. I'll stand up for my rights and other prisoners' rights, but I'll take myself down. I ain't taking you down with me. I'm not going to ask you to come and battle this screw with me. If I had a problem with a screw, I'd go and put it on in myself.
Yeah.
Because I'm staunch like that.
Yeah. See, after your 3 years at Grendon, was it your choice to go or how does it work?
Well, what happened for me, you know, I'd done so much extensive work there and I really, really done well. And the one thing I will say about Grendon, I don't say this stuff for a fair ego or whatever, I actually got an award from the Lord Chief Justice at the time, because what happened is towards my, I still had over 3 years left to serve when I was coming to the end of Grendon. I weren't going home, you know what I mean? But what actually happened is I started a little project in there, me and a couple of others. We started going out to schools and things with a prison officer. I used to go out, I went out on four or five occasions with a prison officer, gave a talk to the students or whatever else about crime and doesn't pay and about drugs and whatever else. I'd done that. And all the time I was in therapy, you know, I'd started a degree as well in Long Latin. You know, I'd done a degree in psychology with the Open University. And I'd done that at the same time as I was doing therapy, believe it or not. So go back to my cell, do my degree and whatever else. And I was getting like past ones, you know. This is someone who'd never been to school. Well, I did go to school, but I wasn't educated. School was just a fucking laugh. I left school with not a single qualification. I think I left there with someone's bike I nicked, but no, that was my qualification. But, you know, I'd left Grendon. You know, I was just a year from getting my degree and everything, and two officers put me up for an award, and I got an award from the Lord Chief Justice, which is, it's in me. I included it in my book, if I remember rightly. I think I did, yeah. I got an award for... Oh, there you go, look.
Yeah.
There's a special recognition to the process...
Rehabilitation. Yeah, congratulations, man.
Well, for the...
camera.
That was for, like, the work I put in.
And did that make you feel good?
You know what, it felt nice.
Is that the first thing you'd ever felt proud of? Which was natural?
I'd got the education bug when I started studying, and I was getting my marks and grades. I was like, fucking brilliant. And I discovered that I could write, you know. I'd writ a few letters, that was it. You know, as you know, I went on to write a book, but I discovered I could write. It did feel nice. It felt like in some ways I was being accepted and I was turning a corner. I think when I first started Grendon, I thought I'd just keep up the act and it'd just be an act and I'll just act my way through. But it became a point when it became very real, like the fight or flight, and it actually did start to work for me. And by the time I left there, I actually fucking believed wholeheartedly in the process of rehabilitation, and I actually started to believe that it was possible for me because my thinking had started to change. And what they'd done for me, they were absolutely fantastic. They put a great care package together for me to try and support me to further it. And I went to a prison in Richmond, Surrey. It's not there no more. Another great thing that prison system's done, it's closed all the good resettlement prisons, and it was what's called a resettlement prison. And I went there for two and a bit years, and for the last 13-14 months of my sentence, I was out working Monday to Friday. I used to go out, I had a job at a scaffold firm, and I used to go to work and come back to the prison of a night time. And it had been my first experience really of holding down a job, working, getting a bit of money, learning to budget and all that stuff. It was phenomenal the way it all sort of mapped out, you know.
Yeah,
it was really good.
How much do you think you spent from the ages of 16 until you got out of prison?
How long did I spend
How much do you think money you spent over the years from drugs, squandering at party lifestyle? Millions?
No, I wouldn't say millions. I've not had millions. Hundreds of thousands.
Yeah.
Undoubtedly. Hundreds of thousands.
And it's scary to think that 20 years of your life for that money, and now you're successful now, and it's natural, and you're doing it work ethic. But again, if you never went through all this shit in your past,
you wouldn't be where you are today.
You wouldn't be where you are today. You wouldn't be writing books.
I earn more money today than what I ever did criminally. It's fucking mad, isn't it? It's like I employ people. You know, I have my own
business.
I own a scaffold company. You know, I employ people. People are dependent on me. I pay my fucking tax. I've got an accountant. I pay me tax. You know, the other day he was saying about, we'll defer the VAT payment again. I said, no, just pay it. I don't want it hanging over, just pay it, you know. He's paying, like, giving 10 grand to the tax man.
Yeah,
you know, I walk into the bank today, you know, I walked into Barclays Bank today, and I needed, you know, I've just bought a new lorry, you know, another lorry, and I walked into Barclays today, and I said, I need 3 months of pay. Oh, hello, Mr. Bishop, or whatever. In the past, I walked into a bank, and fucking
case in the joint,
cover.
Yeah.
I walk in now, they call me.
Do you ever,
Mr.
see
Bishop.
When you walk into a bank now, do you ever get excited? Do you ever still case the joint, look at cameras,
never.
Look at.
Never, it's different rules now, you know, you're going to get caught.
Yeah.
No one can do robberies now without getting caught. There's AMPR cameras everywhere, the technology.
It's just fucking
now.
Grasses everywhere, though,
grasses
as well.
Everywhere. And what's been the game changer is the poker. I don't know if you know what POCR is. No. It's called the Proceeds of Crime Act.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
Now they can just basically come and take everything off. Yeah. You know, and that's the game changer. I mean, why, you know, you can go out and earn fucking millions of pounds doing whatever and they'll come and fucking take the lot one day.
Do you think, though, then that all stems down to the younger generation to be educated more? Because I always say it as well, even your entrepreneurial skills from drug dealers, they've got those skills to be selling something else. It's just, it's all they know. It's a product they've got and they're building a network.
Most definitely. But I think a lot of the youngsters today are being failed miserably by, not society, they're being failed miserably by the ruling fucking elite. Mm-hmm. You know, have a look at, I mean, we was talking about it earlier, the property prices in London and all that, it's fucking unobtainable for these youngsters. They can't afford to leave home. They can't go and get, you know, a lot of them do, I know, but, you know, if you ain't got a bank of mum and dad and all that there, that we've learned no fucking lessons. When I was a kid, we got into crime, not because we were bad people, we got into crime because there was not a lot of options for
us. To survive.
And we were impoverished. I'd be lying if I said we weren't impoverished. And there was no racism or anything like that where I grew up. You know, some of my best friends were black. We was all in the, you know, we were all fucking scumbags as far as everyone else was concerned. We were equally as fucking scummy. But yeah, nowadays, you know, I really feel sorry for a lot of the youngsters, but I'm not making excuses for them. A lot of them are little fucking savages running around with knives and everything like that. They're all gangsters and it's all something to be proud of and whatever. Yeah. And it ain't, but they don't know no fucking different.
Because you've been there yourself, you know
I've
what it's
been
like.
Been there, it's sad, it's tragic.
Yeah. What was it like then, coming out? Were you scared coming out, or did you think, 100%. I've fully changed, I'm going to give it a go?
No, but you probably
says that every time you've come out.
No, I knew it was going to be hard. I knew it was going to be hard when I come out.
Did you have a plan or anything?
Well, like the great John Lennon once said, life is something that happens when you're busy making other plans, you know. I came out and I had all these wonderful plans and I met a bird and it all went fucking wrong.
As it does, isn't it?
I met a woman, it all went fucking wrong. My plans went out the window in a short period of time. But even though I did have a couple of hiccups along the way, my mate explains it beautifully. You know, I like to say I came out of Grendon, I've done fantastic, I've done well. No, I actually fucking, in the time I came out, I actually ended up getting nicked for another two armed robberies, another firearm charge. Very lucky I wasn't lifed off.
After Grendon. After you thought you'd changed and...
Let me save myself here. Yeah,
okay.
What actually happened is I had a bit of a breakdown. And it was because I was suffering from something called bipolar, and I never knew anything about it. I'd always suffer from depression. As a kid, I used to get anxiety attacks and things like that. I was diagnosed with being bipolar, and I went a bit off my head, and I went on this stupid, mad robbery spree for like 3 days. Got about $6,000 or $7,000 or something at the time. That was what the sum total of these robberies come to. I had more than that in the fucking bank. And even the judge could see it was clear insanity. Yeah. And I was very lucky. So after I came out of Grendon, I got what's called an EPP sentence. I got a 5 EPP, which is at the end of that 5 year, I had a extended public protection where I was a MAPA, which is Mulvey Agency Public Protection, all that rubbish. And I had to have all these stringent conditions on me when I got out to make sure I wasn't a threat and whatever. But that was the breaking point. When I went back away after having the experience of Grendon and having a little experience of freedom and going back away again, ending up in Wormwood Scrubs, Peterborough, being moved around the system again because of your record procedure and whatever. But then going, you know what? It kicked in. All what I'd learnt in Grendon kicked in. And I've been out of jail now for over 5 years.
Yeah, congratulations.
And in the 5 years I've been out, I've wrote my autobiography. I started my scaffold company. I've stayed drug-free, most importantly, crime-free. You know, I choose my company wisely. I give back to society, you know. I give talks. I go to schools, universities. I've been in a grammar school recently. I attend recovery meetings or whatever else. My life has gone full circle. It's almost like I don't recognise the man I once was. But I don't, we were talking about this as well, weren't we? I don't take that for granted, you know. I have to take action every day because the demons are always there. But for today, they're in check, you know.
Yeah, today's a good day, and that's, listen, yeah, that's the beauty of life. The fact that you've been through fucking hell, you've caused hell,
yeah,
but it all stems again from being bullied, then trying to make a name for yourself, getting power, trying to get a bit of money, and then the drug abuse. We're searching for all the stuff externally. And the fact that you went through Grendon, see, when you came out after your 3 years in Grendon, after your big sentence, did you go back on the drugs again?
I did after a period. I had a relapse. That was like a precursor, but I think the mental health stuff happened before I picked up. Something was not right. And what happened is I was actually doing quite well when I came out. Financially, I was doing okay. I was in scaffolding. I was doing quite well. And I started to go a little bit off key, a little bit. Something weren't right. And I always knew something weren't right, but no one ever
identified that.
No one ever picked up on it. And it was only during that last sentence that I'd done that, when I was assessed again by Home Office psychiatrist again before, because initially what happened when I was arrested for the firearms offences and whatever, and like I said to you, I was downstairs in that flat, I'd actually took someone hostage, one of my mates, for some unknown reason. I was out of me nut, I took him hostage, armed police stormed the flat to get him out, and they were going to shoot me. They told me that afterwards. But because of the nature of that crime, again, I had to be assessed by psychiatrists to see if I was even fit to plead at the trial when I was arrested. Because they was.
How did you not get life?
Because the psychiatrist saved me. Psychiatric report saved me after I'd been arrested for that, because they said I was suffering from a condition called bipolar, which I now, I take medication for every night. I take a tablet. Just keeps me, stops balanced, me going
too high or too low.
Too low. It just keeps me sort of there.
Yeah.
I had a lot of counselling when I was doing that sentence, when I was doing that, the 5-EPP, a lot of therapy, and above all, stayed drug-free myself. Because if you're prone to anything mental, anything like that, which everyone is, you know, I talk about mental illness openly because every single person on this planet will suffer it at one point in their life, albeit just a bit of mild depression or whatever. But if you take substances and things and you're a little bit nuts already, you know, it ain't fucking rocket science, is it? Do you know what I mean?
Sends you over the edge.
Thick plus thick equals thick,
doesn't it? So you went through all that then, and then you've made a great transition the last 5 years to make the changes, get a business running.
Yeah.
How are you feeling then now? Do you still have negative thoughts? You still have moments?
You know what? I feel like a new man. I feel like a new man. My great, you know, financially I'm okay. I've got my business and whatever else. And I've got some good friends in my life, people that care about me and people I care about. I'm with a lovely woman. I've got my two little Shih Tzu dogs that mean the world to me. I've got my children in my life. I've got a stepdaughter who's an absolute angel. I love her to bits. So I've got the family life, the stability, you know, and my partner's worse than any prison officer, you know. When there's bang up in my ass, it's bang up, you know what I mean? Like, it's like being in a high security prison sometimes. Where you going with?
Yeah.
She's lovely, I love her to bits. But I've got that stability, that home life. The Nelson Mandela said it, didn't he? The greatest things in life may not always be free, but the greatest things in life are being free.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and for me, that is so true. You know, I'm free today. I'd rather be, if I lost everything tomorrow, as long as I'm clean, as long as I'm out here, I've got a chance. In there, got no chance. And for me, the stakes are very high, very real. I'm not the sort of fella that goes out and goes and gets arrested and gets 3 months or 6 weeks and then comes out, I'll beat his bag, it's gangster. I get nicked, it's very real. I'm going away for a long fucking period of time. Probably a lot of it's going to be in segregations, or next time they'll nut me off. They'll send me to one of the places where I won't get out. Because you're at the end of the road, what more can I do with you?
Do you have anyone in contact with, like, social workers? You still haven't licensed or anything?
Never. I'm a free man. For the first time, 2 years ago, I was released, finally, by the English probation system or whatever else. First time for over 30 years, I never had no chains, no constraints, no bit of elastic, no nothing. I'm even allowed to have a British passport again. I was banned from having one for 10 years.
When was the last time you went on holiday?
Oh, fucking hell. I went to the Isle of Wight last year. That was nice.
Was that the first time you've been away?
Well, yeah. I've been the length and breadth of the country, but only in jail. Yeah. I've seen it all on a sweatbox, but I'm going to take my, you know, the reality of it is I can afford to go anywhere I want today. You know, I'm not being flash, but I can afford to go to a beautiful island paradise tomorrow. And all I've got to do is get my passport. Now, I've been allowed to have it for over about two and a half years now. I've been allowed to have a passport, and I still ain't fucking applied for it.
Does it scare you to maybe go away again?
Yeah, 100%.
The checks at fucking airport, and you're going to get fucking red flag. You'll break the computer, man, once you fucking scan your passport.
I've said that to her. I've said that when we go through customs, expect a pull. They will pull me. Oh, 100%.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You'll be red flagged, man.
100%. Yeah. They'll pull me straight away. They'll search any vehicle I'm in. They'll search me. What is the nature of your business? Where you're going? All of that. When I apply for a passport, I'm probably going to have, you know,
restrictions.
I might even have to go and have an interview and all that. And the reason why is because the nature of the offences.
Yeah.
And it, because it's, you, when you, back then I was smuggling people into the country, and I mean, that's a terrible crime, a bad crime, but only I got involved in it, like through the back door. I wasn't supposed to actually be smuggling people, it was supposed to be drugs. Well,
do you think
I'm not,
you get set up for
right. I know I walked into somebody else's observation, and I think it was the people that they were working with on the continent. And the reason I know is because I actually met them at a service station at a different part of France. You know, I never made any statement. I made no statement. No one ever got arrested with me. I was done for being the ringleader. They knew I weren't. But when it came into court, initially I was going to plead not guilty and plead duress, say I was forced to do it or whatever. Drug debt, the usual, everyone knew. Everyone
would there have been a lesser sentence in France?
Oh, yeah, I'd probably got 3 years in France.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what happened is I heard about this service station in one of the customs reports, and then what they'd done is they'd done something called PII, which is public immunity, whatever, with all their covert surveillance. They refused to reveal their covert surveillance to my solicitor. And the only reason they could refuse to reveal their covert surveillance, obviously there was vital intel in there that we're not allowed to see. Grass, perhaps, I would say more likely, and it goes on all the time, that the actual crime was instigated in some way by infiltration by either police, customs, Interpol, MI5, NCIS, one of these organisations. They actually infiltrate these gangs and play pivotal roles in the gang. To bring down the whole gang, you know what I mean? It's like you see on the films. This goes on. Police, not police, these shady world and whatever, they when the crime's a bit organised, that's what happens.
Yeah, it's all fucking corrupt, isn't it?
100%.
All corrupt. 100%. So plans for the future then, Ray? You're doing well, you're a free man, you can get your passport.
You know, I've got, I mean, I review a lot of books, like, you know, I've just reviewed Terry's, which is fantastic. I reviewed Linda Calvey's The Black Widow, you know, what a lovely woman. You know, Mel's a good friend of mine. Linda's book, fantastic. Razor said to give his book a plug. He's got the Dirty Dozen.
Yeah, when's his book coming out?
Well, he's got the Dirty Dozen coming out in August for John Blake Publishing.
Yeah, so that's month.
Oh, it'd be the most.
We'll leave the link on this podcast for description for Noel Razor Smith. Great man, he's been on the podcast.
Do you know what? Razor's, for me, he's the best true crime author out there. Yeah. This one, the Dirty Dozens. If you want to know about armed robbery and the making of armed robbery, that's the one. But and then I've got my own book coming out soon, hopefully, called Smuggler's Roulette.
I'll get you back on, we'll talk about
that'd be wonderful. I'd be really grateful.
Yeah, 1,000,000%.
Smuggler's Roulette is about my 3 years in the smuggling, but I always knew when I wrote Outlaw, I always knew I would have to dedicate a whole book to it, because there was so much that happened and so many tales and funny stories, and I didn't want to, when I wrote this book, I wanted it to really carry a message to youngsters, and I was trying to deter them. There's nothing glamorous about crime and whatever, and I felt in some sense I owed to the victims of my own actions and whatever, to give them an understanding of why people do what they do and whatever. And it's never okay to make a victim.
Yeah, 1,000,000%, never. Man, but you've got to live with that stuff. But again, you've got to understand that we are human. We do make mistakes. Some crimes are more hard-hitting than others, but again, the beauty of life, brother, people can change. Your prime example, Noel Razor Smith, prime example, Terry Ellis, Billy Moore.
Well, I've made a commitment to myself. I fucked up the first half of my life.
Yeah.
And I'm going to do my damn best to try and make a go.
Yeah,
second
like
half.
I say, you write books, mate. You've got the pen to write your life.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
And it's not finished yet.
Yeah. The best years of your life are always ahead of you. I always say that to people. People need to believe that you are the creator of your destiny. Most always definitely. See it. You can change.
One thing I will always say is anyone out there who's suffering from any mental health issues, any drug addiction, anything like that, anyone out there who thinks crime, anything like that, or thinks there's no way out or whatever, never give up hope and tap into the professional services or whatever else, whatever offers out there, tap into it. Because when I was young, I didn't even know it fucking existed. Maybe if someone had grabbed me at a young age and said, look, come and talk about things, well, maybe my life would have been different. Mm-hmm. You know, a poor girl the other day where I live, 18 years old, she jumped in front of a train. Oh, that's heartbreaking.
Yeah,
heartbreaking.
Sad.
And it's, when I hear things like that today, it tears me up inside, you know. I think, you know, get someone, talk to someone, don't suffer.
Yeah, that's the best thing to do, whether it's a friend, a neighbour, the postman. If you talk to someone, man, releasing that stress or pressure.
Talk to your dog, I do.
Yeah, talk to the fucking ceiling.
My dog understands me, it's anyone that does.
Yeah. Before we finish up, we must talk about your boxing as well.
Yeah.
Street fights, was it street fights? Or
well,
what happened?
I mean, I had the boxing career, didn't I? When I came out of prison initially, I went back into my boxing and I was an unlicensed fighter. You know, I was never going to get my pro licence because of my criminal record. The boxing world is... You know, there's some fantastic ambassadors for the sport, but it's very pompous, the governing bodies. For me, I was at that semi-pro sort of level. I'd probably been good enough to be a journeyman pro. I'm not going to say I'd been, I don't mean as good as some of the greats out there, but I was game and I could have a row. And I boxed for an organisation and I took it as far as I could. And they had their own version of a British title, and I won that British title. You know, that was a sense of achievement because I was 35 years old at the time, and they said, you're too old, you won't do it, wherever else. And the reality of it is, I won most of my fights. You know what I mean? I was quite a good fighter, and I'd done a lot of good training kids, and we had our own little boxing camp and camaraderie. Yeah, so I've been down that road and had earned my stripes there.
Do you still train?
I still train now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just getting back into training and hopefully doing a bit of coaching as a little pastime. And then the lockdown happened. But I've built a big scaffolding in my garden and put a punch bag on it and all that. So
keep active. Yeah good, brother. Yeah. Ray, listen, it's been an absolute pleasure, brother.
Thank you, James.
I've thoroughly enjoyed your story. You, Noel, Terry, your stories are phenomenal. I love
the fact
that what you've been through and the fact that you've changed, mate. So I take my hat off to you.
Thank you, James.
Thank you. You're a good guy, mate. Stay strong, brother. Stay in the path and keep fighting.
Thank you.
You can also watch my podcast on my YouTube channel. The link is in the bio if you'd like to subscribe. You can follow me on my social media platforms to see who my next guest is. Follow me on Facebook at JamesEnglish11, Twitter, JamesEnglish0, Instagram, James English 2. You can also download these podcasts on iTunes or Spotify.